Okay. So, picking up where we left off with really the last two sacrifices last time, and they are interconnected of a sort. So that's just fine that we're still on those. We were talking about the sin or purification offering last time, and if you remember last time, generally when we see this offering talked about or referred to in Scripture, it is almost always referred to as the sin offering. However, that name might misconstrue some things, I think. I think the offering itself, when we look at the various instances where it's prescribed, it's not always for quote-unquote moral sin. So, yes, it can be in an instance where an unintentional sin has taken place, and that's certainly what this is for. This is not for intentional, deliberate, premeditated sins. That's not what the sin offering is for. But in the case of unintended sin or unintentional, that's what really this is for. However, we all also see the sin offering sometimes prescribed, for instance, after a woman has given birth, she is to offer a sin offering. Now, there's nothing sinful about having a child, right? And yet it is prescribed. And we see Mary do this after Jesus is born, after her time of her time after he's born is over. She comes, and in order to complete this kind of ritual of cleanness and purification, she offers a sin offering, the doves, and we see that in the Gospels. So just to refer to it as a sin offering, I won't quite say it's a misnomer, but it's a little broader than that, and we need to think about it that way. Okay, so when we think about it, maybe we think about it in terms of maintaining sanctity. And we talked about this a little bit last time in terms of, think about it like an operating room. The room itself has to stay clean, and the people within the room have to stay clean in order for it to be effective. So a sterile field has to be maintained. So that's what the sin offering is for. It is to make the person clean of a sort, to purify them, so that they can then be in the presence of God. Okay? And again, as we talked about right at the end of class last time, this is not for, as Numbers 15 refers to it, high-handed sins. This is not, I'm rebelling against God, I know this is wrong, I'm going to do it anyways because I don't care. This is mostly for unintentional sin. There's a few caveats there. Now, really, when we think about it that way, the fact that this is for unintended sin, think about Hebrews chapter 10 in that regard. Turn over there very quickly. Hebrews chapter 10. And really, our study of Leviticus hopefully will broaden your study of the book of Hebrews when we consider the concepts that are in play and how Jesus is a better sacrifice and a better high priest. And he's better in all these ways. But if we look in Hebrews chapter 10, verses 26 through 28, this may sound familiar. For if we deliberately sin after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. Okay? So if Israel, in the case of the old law, if Israel in the case of the old law knows that something is sinful and they do it anyways, there's not a sacrifice for that. You can't commit the sin, say, yeah, I know it's wrong, I'll just offer a sacrifice later and be fine. It doesn't work that way. And so the concept is pulled forward then in Hebrews when the Hebrew writer says, if we deliberately sin after receiving the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins, but a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of a fire about to consume the adversaries. If anyone, and he clarifies here, he specifies, if anyone disregards Moses' law, he dies without mercy. There is no mercy for the one that deliberately sins in the face of the law. Based on the testimony of two or three witnesses, how much worse punishment do you think one will deserve who has trampled on the Son of God, the ultimate sacrifice, regarded as profane the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified, and insulted the Spirit of grace. So we think there's judgment, there's harsh judgment in the Old Testament when we read it. But if we look at the New Testament, many of those concepts are still in play in terms of judgment. Eddie.
In verse 19 sets that context there in Hebrews 10, which is exactly the same context as the entire book of Leviticus.
Yes.
Entering into the holy place.
Yes. Yes. And being holy.
Yeah.
And being holy, we can't have a knowledge of sin and then participate in sin anyways, thinking, well, the blood of Jesus will cover me. It doesn't work that way. I mean, that flies in the whole face of Romans, right? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Absolutely not. And so the concept is the same. So this sin offering, again, not for premeditated sin. Now, there are some sins, some, especially the unintentional department, but again, there's some nuance to this. There are some sins which are against other people, which might take something away from them or damage something that belongs to them. And so for that, there is a restitution, a repayment that is necessary. And in those cases, there is also the restitution offering. Okay, and so there's three categories of this. So first of all, there's an unintentional withholding of a tithe or an offering to God. Okay, you brought your sacrifice, or you were supposed to bring something on a day, and really it really just either slipped your mind, or you did something a little out of place that wasn't in complete lineup with the law. There's a cover for that. Okay, so unintentionally withholding a tithe or an offering to God, you can sacrifice a ram, and then an additional, you pay what you owe plus an additional 20%, and then that's for that. The second instance there is an unintentional violation of the Lord's commands regarding things that are not to be done. Okay, or yours might say things that belong to the Lord. Okay, if you accidentally bring something that is, you didn't know it was unclean, but then you later had a knowledge of it. Again, these things are unintentional. So there's not, the law is not without mercy is kind of where we're going with this. Now, in part three, this is where I say there's a little bit of nuance in terms of the deliberate, not deliberate thing. So in the third instance here, withholding the return of collateral. So, for instance, somebody loans something, and certainly you're not supposed to take interest, but you can take collateral. And if they pay that back and you then withhold that collateral, you're not allowed to do that. Or you defraud somebody. You're not quite completely honest in your business dealings with them. Or you find an item that somebody lost, you know that they lost it, or you come to a knowledge of the fact that they lost it, and you just kind of hide the fact that you found it. You don't really give it back. Again, there is a small amount of deliberation here, but under the guilt of restitution offering, these statutes are here. And so then the purpose, the overall purpose, to compensate for unintentional, negligent, or even deceptive deprivation of another's rights. And that can apply to God or man. So when we look at the sacrifice, are there any additional comments or questions about the sin and restitution offerings? And really, a restitution offering is a type of sin offering, but there's more to it. There's an additional repayment aspect there. Okay, I'm going to take your silence to mean that everybody knows exactly what's going on, and we're all clear to Leviticus to this point. Okay, so now kind of going back and looking at these categories then, we started our discussion of the sacrifices with these categories. The burnt offering, grain offering, peace offering, the sin or purification offering, and the restitution offering. Now, one of the things we've said that we're trying to do throughout this study is we're trying to get concepts from these things. And we've seen these various sacrifices, what's involved in them. Now let's maybe look at some of the concepts involved. So for the burnt offering, It's access to God. That's a little bit faded out there. It's access to God. That's what the burnt offering is for. Remember, it's like knocking on the front door when you're asking to come to someone's home. You're entreating God for access. The grain offering is a covenant reminder. Remember, we talked about that. It said that with the grain offerings, with all your offerings, you are to offer salt. And he refers to it as the covenant of salt or the covenant salt. We don't really have time to go into more detail on that, but either way, they're supposed to offer salt with all of their offerings. The peace offering is fellowship with God. It's a recognition of peace with God and a gratitude for peace with God, that we can have that peace with God. And really, you know, that should make you think of Ephesians 2 and 3, about how he's brought the two together and both are brought into communion with God. And that's all part of his ultimate plan. Okay, so the sin or purification offering, it's sanctification, the thing that sets them apart for God's service and allows them to take part in that, is purifying themselves. And that sin offering is a part of that. And then for restitution is contrition and justice. When I realize that I have overstepped, and again, many times that's an unintentional thing. When I realize I've overstepped, I genuinely want to do the right thing. And so then I say, I'm sorry for this. Here is what I owe. Please welcome me back into your favor. So there are concepts in play here. And they're concepts I think that we can see move completely forward to the New Testament as well. And the overall big picture. Any comments or questions about the sacrifices? David.
I have NIV translation in verse 5:15 uses the word penalty of they are being, they are to bring the Lord to the Lord as a penalty. Does that clash with the concept of contrition and justice?
Let's see. Okay, so Leviticus 5:15, and I'll just let me read from a different version here. Okay.
It doesn't
have
anything like that. So
yeah.
The word penalty kind of...
I think it's a translation thing. I mean, the idea is the same. There is a penalty incurred. I mean, that it's something that has to be done to put you back in good standing. And really, that's what a penalty is, right? You think, for instance, in hockey, you commit a penalty. You got to go spend time in the box until you can come back out again, and so on and so forth. I think many translations will say something to the effect of he must bring his either restitution offering or I'm not sure what some of the other words there might be.
Guilt offering.
Okay. Yeah. Guilt. Okay. So that's one that's used as well. And again, the idea is to put oneself back into a right state. And the offering is the prescription to do that. Anything else?
One thing kind of comes to mind, what you just said, I think from our viewpoint, that may be the only thing we think of.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is we just want to say, well, let me just make it right and then everything's okay. Mm-hmm. But those other four points are very significant.
Yes.
In God's eyes, and that's the part that we neglect.
Right. Right. Well, and that's the part that often trips us up when we're thinking about the law, right? Again, we, you know, and it's just how we think of it a lot of times. These are check boxes. You meet this check box, you get the benefit, bing, bang, boom, we're set. Okay? But these concepts have to be in play. God was trying to discipline his people, and discipline is a teaching thing. We often think of discipline just in the punishment aspect, but discipline is teaching. And so that's what God is doing through these sacrifices, through the days that we're getting ready to go through. God is teaching his people. And remember, we go all the way back to the first lesson and we think about when Israel came out of Egypt, they had to learn, first of all, who God was. And secondly, they had to learn who they were in relation to God. And so these are all part of that. And when we get to the holy days here in just a minute, I think we'll see that as well. Anything else? Okay, well, let's jump right in. We've talked about the kind of ritual sacrifices. Now let's dive right into the sacred calendar. Okay, so some things to keep in mind with the sacred calendar. Again, there are major ideas in play here. All right? When we have a husband and wife, I'm just going to use that as a relationship that comes to mind, and it can apply to any relationship, really. But you have a husband and a wife. What is the best thing that you can give to your spouse or to your significant other? Is it gifts, presents? Is it money?
Unconditional love.
Unconditional love? Well, yeah, okay. All right, I'll give you that one. But how do you show unconditional love? Gifts, money, presents?
You give yourself.
Okay, a different kind of presence, right? Presence, C-E. Right, it's time. Time, okay? So when we think about these holy days, when we think about these times that are set apart, first of all, again, to know who you are, to know your identity, and this is true for all of us, to know who you are, you must remember where you came from. Okay? Your family identity, your background. I'm from Birmingham, Alabama. There's a lot about me, if any of you know me, that is wrapped up in my identity being from Alabama. Okay? I got this crazy accent. I love fried foods. I love football. I say Roll Tide. All of these things are wrapped up in, you know, the things that I do and the things that I say and who I am are wrapped up in where I came from. And that's not to say that we're completely defined by our past. Certainly there are things that we can change about where we come from. But our experiences are built throughout our lives and our past is a part of that. Okay? So to know your identity, and especially in the case of Israel, you have to remember where you came from. All right? And isn't that what we tell our kids whenever they leave the house, right? Remember who you are? That's all part of it. Okay, but the second major thing, though, is dedicated time. Time that we set apart for someone is the currency of a healthy relationship. Okay? I can give Amanda all the presents I can think of. She's the hardest person to shop for in the world. But I can give her all the presents I can think of, but nothing will ever be as valuable to her as the time that we just spend together. And that's true for anyone, whether it's a marriage relationship, a parent-child relationship, a teacher-student relationship. Think about the most significant relationships in your life that meant something to you. It is almost always because somebody took time to spend with you. Alex talked about that a little bit tonight. Okay, it's investing in someone. And so that's really what these sacred days are about. You're giving value, showing that you give value to God by the amount of time that you want to spend with Him. Okay? Now, what you may notice if you go through Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy, just kind of as a housekeeping note, you may notice some subtle differences, or really outright differences, between some of the days and what's required in them. Okay? This is, I don't view those as a contradiction. This is not a means of discrediting Scripture. It just is what it is. But think, for instance, about the Passover. Okay? How was the first Passover in, well, first of all, when was the first Passover? Not in terms of year, but what was happening? Okay, it was in Egypt. They were getting ready to leave Egypt, right? They were getting ready to leave Egypt in a hurry. So the prescription, the standards for the Passover were given, first of all, so that they could leave quickly, and secondly, in the situation they were in. So remember, they had to roast, roast the food, and then they had to make the unleavened cake, and then they had to put the blood on the doorposts. Okay? Well, if you're out in the wilderness, where are those doorposts at that you were supposed to put blood on? And is there anything in the Passover instructions later on about putting blood on doorposts? Or do we see that in Jesus' time? No, there's not. Okay, so it's changed. Well, change is a bad... It's been modified because of the situation. It doesn't change the meaning of it. It doesn't change many of the symbols along with it, but there are subtle differences between some of these things. And if you look through, especially as we start getting into Deuteronomy, but it also happens in Leviticus and Numbers as well, many of these regulations are precluded or preempted by the phrase, when you come into the land. So there are some of these regulations that they're supposed to do immediately. But some of these can't be done until they do actually get into the land. We're going to see some festivals, again, that have to do with harvest and things like that. Well, they're in the middle of the wilderness. They're not planting crops in the middle of the wilderness. Long-term crops that are meant to be seeded and reseeded year after year after year. Their purpose is not to stay there. And so the regulation then starts with when you come into the land. So some of these are modified based on the circumstance they're given in, and then later they're amended or further clarification is given. So just want to throw that out there. Okay, now as we're looking at some of these, they will give specific days of the year. And the Jewish calendar runs similar but slightly different to our own calendar. For instance, we just started a new year. We're in January of 2020. Their new year, however, starts in our mid-March. Okay? Now that says Nisan. That's actually, that name has changed. If you look in the scriptures, especially back in Exodus, it is the month of Abib. The first month is when the Passover is begun. Interesting note. Here's your freebie for the night. Abib starts in March. The name Abib means sheaves, green sheaves of barley. Okay? What happens in March? Things start to sprout, right? So the name of the month has to do with what's happening at that particular time, at least in that case. So just an interesting tidbit. But either way, so when we're talking about these months and we're talking about harvest season, things like that, and he says the first month of the year, we're not talking about the dead of winter in terms of our year. We start our year on a solar calendar, and it's a Gregorian calendar and all those types of things. This calendar is a little bit different, okay? But think about it in terms of this. Much of the Jewish calendar is based on lunar rather than solar, the phases of the moon. So they have new moon festivals and all those types of things. And their months are based on the lunar cycle for the most part. Think back to Genesis chapter 1. I know that's faded out, but Genesis 1:14. When God created, we have the account of God creating the sun and the moon, the greater and lesser lights in the sky. What is the purpose of those, does he say in Genesis 1:14? To mark days and years and... what? Festivals. Appointed times. And the same word that he uses there for festivals or appointed times is the same word that God is going to use in giving Moses the law. This is my appointed day, or these appointed days. The exact same word as in Genesis 1:14. So God had this in mind from the very beginning. Isn't that interesting? How the plan all plays out. Okay, so, and I'm going to keep that, for some of these days, I'm going to keep that calendar up there. And we're going to go very quickly through some of these because I want to go a little bit longer on some of the ones at the end and again, go back to some concepts. Okay, so, I should have used a totally different color there. You have the main eight appointed times. We have the weekly Sabbaths. We have the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Offering of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, which we know today as Pentecost, the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Booths. And these are basically laid out, boom, 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 in Leviticus chapter 23. We get some nuances to those regulations in Leviticus 24 and some narrative part in Leviticus 24. And then Leviticus 25 picks up talking not about annual festivals, but about festivals that happen many years apart. Okay? So in the case of the Sabbath year, they're 7 years apart. And in the case of the year of Jubilee, they're 49 to 50 years apart. All right? So we're gonna look at each one of these things. So just let's kick it right off with the weekly Sabbaths. All right? Where do we first read about the weekly Sabbath? Where do we first see it commanded? Okay. All right. You got me there. Creation. Okay. Yeah. Okay. How about commanded of the people? Exodus 20. Yeah. Ten commandments. I mean, command should be a big word there. Commandments. The Ten Commandments. The fourth commandment. Okay. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Okay. So the weekly Sabbaths are instituted in Exodus 16, but also Exodus chapter 20 commanded. And on these days, God says you're to have a holy convocation or a sacred assembly. When I went to Berea College, we had to do convocations. You had to have so many convocations per semester. And that's basically just a time that everybody's supposed to come together for a designated purpose. We convocate when we congregate together. Every so often. So it's a holy convocation. Now, in terms of the Old Testament, we don't really have a historical reference for what these convocations on the Sabbath, every weekly Sabbath, really looked like. But as we get into New Testament times, we really see the Sabbaths coming into play more and more, right? And really, that generally it's thought of as they were out of the land and in captivity, and especially during the times of silence, when they had to have the synagogues and all of those things came into play, it became so much more important to them to do these weekly Sabbaths. But certainly they should have been in play the whole time. We've talked about this before. On the Sabbath, no one could do any work. That's not just Israel. It's anybody at all is not supposed to do work. That's Israel, that's foreigners, that's animals. Nobody is supposed to do work. And you're not supposed to do that even during the plowing or harvest season when things are the busiest. When your grass is getting up to be a foot tall, you cannot take the lawnmower out there and get at it. Okay? So don't do it. And then the penalty for that is pretty harsh. It's death. If you work on the Sabbath, death. Okay? It is that holy to God. And that the importance of setting time apart is kind of underlined there. And so then on the Sabbaths, the priests were to offer two additional lambs and then to replace the showbread in the holy place. Recall that's the 12 loaves of bread that were presented before the veil and kept there. And so they replaced that on a weekly basis. Now, what's the purpose of the Sabbaths? Well, first of all, I mean, the obvious part is it's a time for rest. You are to rest on the Sabbath. And as Peggy said, just as God did on the seventh day of creation, you are to rest. And so that's a sign for you. Secondly, it's a regular reminder. According to Deuteronomy chapter 5, we're kind of getting out of the Leviticus text a little bit. But according to Deuteronomy chapter 5, it's a reminder that they had been slaves in Egypt with no days of rest. And so Egypt took from Israel, God gave to Israel. And we have to see that when we contrast those two existences. And then number three, in Exodus chapter 31, God refers to the Sabbath as a covenant sign. It is part of the covenant. So just as important as things like circumcision and keeping the Ten Commandments and all of those things is the Sabbath rest. It is all wrapped up in the covenant. And by doing that, you show future generations that, first of all, you're God's people. And secondly, that you're set apart from the other nations. The other nations aren't getting a Sabbath rest like this. There's nothing like this in any other law. So God sets this apart, and he sets them apart by them doing this. So it's another sign. Okay, the Passover is the next one we come to in verses 4 and 5 of chapter 23. The Passover takes place at the beginning of the Jewish calendar. Matter of fact, it's the very beginning of the Jewish yearly calendar. of the religious year. It's at twilight on the 14th day of the month. Okay, so it begins at dusk. And again, we see that in the Exodus narrative, don't we? And so it's to be kept by the whole congregation of Israel. And they're to offer a year-old sheep or goat, roasted or broiled. We've got the precedent set for that, with no broken bones and eaten with bitter herbs, just as they did in the time that it was first offered. And so the purpose of the Passover is a perpetual memorial to remember the night that God passed over the firstborn of the Israelites in Egypt. As we go through these special days, see how the story of the Exodus progresses. I will say this to anybody I'm studying the Bible with. If we're doing a big picture of the Bible, in order to get many parts of the Bible, you need to know the Exodus narrative. Because it's your story, it's Israel's story, it's all wrapped up in it. And it's referenced throughout Scripture. So in order to truly understand who we are, we've got to realize where we came from. And the Passover is a big part of that. Now, do we observe a type of Passover today? Give me a yes. What is it?
Christ is our Passover.
Christ is the Passover lamb. And so then in observance of that, in memorial of that, what do? What's that? We partake of the Lord's Supper. That's right. We have communion. That's right. Okay, so Passover, very important. Important for them, important for us. Moving on, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Okay, Feast of Unleavened Bread is the day after the Passover. It's on the 15th of the month and actually runs for 8 days. And so on the first day, which is a Sabbath, they're to have complete rest. And on the seventh day, they're to have complete rest. The regulations, again, only unleavened bread could be eaten. All leaven was to be removed from every home, and then burnt offerings are presented on each day of that feast. The purpose for it being a retelling of the story of Israel's last night in Egypt and the haste with which they left. They're not to put leaven in the bread. You can't wait on the bread to rise before you take it. You need to get the unleavened bread going and get out of Dodge. All right? So it's a reminder of that. And they're to have a week-long feast based on that. Moving forward, we have the offering of first fruits. Verses 9 through 14. Again, this is associated with the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's during the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And it's on the day after. And the subtext there is the first Sabbath is what's implied there in verse 23, chapter 23, verse 11. And so in this, they're to bring a sheaf of the first crops. Remember, we're in mid-March here. They're to bring a sheaf of the first crops to the high priest as a wave offering. Okay? Now, in some of these things, we see what's referred to as a heave offering. It's something that's heaved or lifted up, and a wave offering, something that is waved in front of God. Okay? And God has prescribed things for all of these things. And so you're to bring a sheaf of the first crops to the high priest, and he waves that before God. And then you have grain offerings and drink offerings and another burnt offering. Really, there's burnt offerings with all of these things. So you'll forgive me if I don't mention that with every single one. But one particular thing here is no one could eat of the first produce of the land until this had been done. Why do you think that is? You got the crops that are starting to sprout. You're able to pluck some of them. You bring the first and the best to God, but nobody eats of it until after that's done. Why is that?
It's not first fruits until you've eaten part of it.
Okay, it's not the first fruits until you've eaten part of it. Okay. And so, you know, in many homes, We let our guests eat first because we're showing deference to them. And so this, we're showing deference to God by not eating of it, partaking of it, until God has been thanked for it. Yes?
How does this look in practice? Does that mean every male that shows up?
That is a good question. And it is a question that is debated. So is this a single offering or is this offered by multiple people? The sources I was reading asked the exact same question, and I do not have a definite answer for that. So, but it is a good question. So then the kind of the meaning behind this, then we've kind of hit on it a little bit. It's an expression of faith in and gratitude for God's provision. The fact that we realize God is providing these things for us. Now, where are they at the time that this regulation is being given? They're in the wilderness. Have they planted crops? Nope. No. So again, this is one of those that we're kind of looking forward to them being in the promised land. So this, there's an element of faith in this, isn't there? God's giving this regulation saying, when you come into the land, you will offer crops. And there's two major things that are implied in that. First of all, you're going to make it to the land. And secondly, when you get there, you're going to have crops. I'm going to help you grow things. I'm going to provide for you. So this is a recognition of that, and one that they're supposed to keep. All right? So looking forward then, the Feast of Weeks, or what we come to know by its Greek term, Pentecost. All right? See some notable things happen on Pentecost. Maybe sometimes we wonder, when we look at Acts 2, where does that term come from? What does that mean? When is this? Well, Pentecost is 7 weeks after offering the first fruits. If you're doing your basic multiplication, 7 times 7 is 49. And then the next day would be the 50th day. 50, Pentecost. Okay? So it's to take place 50 days after that seventh Sabbath that we read about. Two loaves from the harvested grain. This is one of the only leavened sacrifices that they could offer to God. Two loaves from the grain that you already harvested earlier in the month, and various sacrifices and things like that. But also, this is where we see the regulation given to the people to leave the edges of the fields and their gleanings for the poor and the foreigner. Now, where do we see that come into play? We see it in Ruth, don't we? Okay? Ruth is a foreigner. She's a Moabite. And so Naomi tells her, go out into the fields and glean after the young men. You know, pick up what they drop on the ground. Now, when we read further in that story, it gives a whole lot more context to Boaz saying to the young men, drop some of the best out of your baskets so that when she comes along, she can pick them up. That says a lot about Ruth, and it says a lot about Boaz. And we learn mercy from that. We learn care for God's people. And so that's where we see that in Leviticus 23:14. And so then the purpose of that, it's a time of rejoicing for liberation from Egypt and for God's provision after Egypt. God provides for them in the wilderness, and Pentecost is to be a reminder of that. Moving quickly ahead, the Feast of Trumpets. The first day of the seventh month is set aside for solemn rest, a memorial proclaimed with, yours might say, jubilation. And what that means is a blast of trumpets. That's what the word is there for. As a matter of fact, the Hebrew word itself sounds like what a trumpet would sound like if you blew it. I can't remember exactly what the word is, but it's like a twee sound or something like that. So it's very interesting. But that day, that Feast of Trumpets, is a memorial of what is not specifically stated, but possibly the blowing of trumpets to call Israel to Sinai. Remember, when they come to the mountain, what do they hear? They hear the sound of trumpets. And then they're called to Sinai. That's not specifically stated, but I thought it was a very good theory. The Day of Atonement, and we're going to hit the high points of the Day of Atonement here because we're going to delve into that a lot more in the couple of classes. But during the Day of Atonement, basically, atonement made for the entire community of Israel. And they were to practice, your translation might say, affliction of soul or humbling of soul. And basically, the idea is that's referring to fasting. You are humbling yourself before your God by withholding those things from yourself. And so there's offerings associated with that. And of course, the Day of Atonement, it's in the name, it's the shared atonement or the cleansing of the spiritual uncleanness to restore Israel's community fellowship with God. So we have many sacrifices that are done on the part of individuals. The Day of Atonement is to be for the entire community. And this is also where we have the two goats, one being sacrificed and one being sent into the wilderness. And again, we'll come back to all of these things in a couple of class periods. The next feast, the last big feast, is the Feast of Booths or Tabernacles. And this is a commemoration of the time that they spent in the wilderness dwelling in temporary dwellings. Now, what's interesting is, at the time that Leviticus is written, where are we in terms of the wilderness wanderings? In terms of the big time frame of the wilderness wanderings? They're at the very start, right? And they don't even know what's coming yet because they haven't... And not that God intended them to do that, but things are getting ready to happen that are going to make this a lot more significant later on. Okay? So they haven't committed the sin yet that's going to keep them from going into the land. The first generation dying out, the second generation being able to go in, and then wandering for 40 years. So they're about to spend a lot more time in tents than they even realize. They're going to spend some intensive time in tents. You knew it was coming. Okay, and so this feast is a recognition of that, okay? And it's a recognition of God's providence for them. They are without a home. They have no permanent dwelling place of their own, not even to go back to Egypt. And God is taking care of them. And their identity and their value is not based on where they live. It's based on God being with them. And so this Feast of Booths is a recognition of that. So two more big events on the sacred calendar. First of all is the Sabbath year. Every 7 years was to be a Sabbath year. They did not plow the fields during that year. They only took of what was growing from what had already sprouted for the entire year. And God says, during that year, if you observe my Sabbaths, I will give you in abundance. You don't worry about, well, I didn't plant anything for this year. We didn't sow the fields. We didn't reap anything. Well, that's not the idea. The idea is God is providing for you, so you give the land rest for a year. And then, did the second bell ring? Did I hear it yet? Okay, all right. And so then the second one then is the year of Jubilee. It did ring. Okay. We were going to go with no, but that's all right. Okay. We'll finish this on Sunday, and then we're going to go into the priesthood at that point. So, thank you very much for your comments.